Right, as far as you know God, and I'm sure you do because that's why you're here, you wouldn't be here otherwise, would you say that he does things usually, in general, quickly, or is he a bit more on a slower side, slower pace?
Seems to be the latter.
Okay.
Does it in his own time?
Yeah.
And is that time, does it go quickly or slowly?
Depends what you're waiting for.
Okay.
I think he does what's right.
Okay, good. Well, he was here about 2,000 years ago. Well, basically, he died and resurrected around 30-31 AD. So really in about 13 years or so, it would be exactly 2,000 years since he came back from the dead, and he reassured his disciples that he's going to prepare a place for them. He'll come back, and then he'll take us to be with him forever. Well, 2,000 years, it's a bit long, isn't it? It's been a while since us as humanity, as Christianity, those people who believe throughout centuries have been waiting.
And left the opportunity to have been born there and to live this life and to accept as we come back 55 years ago while we've been here.
Good. Good. Very good. I like that. That's a good point. But still, it's a long time. It's a long time. 2 millennia. And the early Christians, most of them believed what Jesus promised for about 3 or 4 centuries, but then after that they started getting a bit tired and weary of waiting and said, well, this world is a rough place, and the Roman Empire, and then the fall of the Roman Empire, and it was a massive, massive place. And, the life expectancy wasn't very great in those days, and gradually the Christians started changing their beliefs. Well, it's a bit long to wait for him to come, let's just change it. So they started saying, you know, just you die and go to heaven and that's it, you know. They're straight away. And you know, you don't have to wait until he comes back. But that's not what he promised. He did say, I'll go away, and then I will come back, and then you will be with me forever. And I suppose we can be affected also in our personal lifetimes, just like Christianity has been throughout centuries. We can also get tired and weary and ask God, and how long? One of the key questions in the Old Testament. And God's people are expecting him to do something. And it is, I have to stick with Steve and say, your first answer, it is long and it is slow and it is hard. I suppose the book of Revelation says, unless you have endurance of the saints, you will not make it. Faith, yes, but unless you have patient endurance, your faith will fizzle out. You really have to endure through whatever comes your way until God's promise is fulfilled. So, why is he taking so long? I mean, if he did what he needed to do on the cross, why take another 2,000 years? Does that make sense to you? The story seems to be going on and on and keeps struggling on. Another question for you. How many comings of Christ are there in the Bible? How many times? How many? Anybody else?
Two.
Good. I like different answers. That's good.
Sorry, I didn't understand.
How many times do you have it? The first coming of Christ? How many times is he coming?
If you're talking on a big scale, 3.
But there are talking on a big scale. Yeah.
Otherwise.
Yes, it is very, you know, it's very long and outstretched, and you wonder why all these complications. There are actually 3 comings of Christ. There's the first one, and the second one, and the third one. Well, have a look at that in a moment. But then it's so elaborate and long, and you wonder why, just, you know, if he's done what he needed to do, on the cross. Why all this stretch? Well, we do not understand how God thinks and what he has to deal with from his perspective. But at least going through the Bible, there is a story. The Bible is made up of many small stories, and that's how we should read them, read it. But then there is a big story that's underlined the entire book. And this big story can be summarized really in one slide. That's what I'm trying to do today. The entire Bible, put it on the screen, to see what this underlining story is, underlying story when you pull the curtains away and see what is unseen, see the invisible, and see what is happening in the realm that God has to deal with. So, you're going to start at the beginning, and there's the middle, and there's the end. There's some symmetry there. Seems to be compiled of seven elements. You all remember how the story begins in the Garden of Eden? Well, it's not as simple, never is it as simple as us and God. And we either do what is right or wrong, that's it. There is, unfortunately, the third party involved. There's a third party, the intruder, the uninvited guest, whom sometimes we choose to invite, willingly or unwillingly. And he portrays as a serpent. He deceived, well, he tempted and deceived Adam and Eve, humankind. So that's really the first part of the story that wouldn't be written for us if that didn't happen. There would be no story if that didn't happen. So, Satan is revealed as the tempter and the deceiver. That's his first station, first off, that's his first strategy. After that, after he deceived them, well, then he moves on to the next step and he becomes the persecutor or the abuser. And you can see the next episode in the story after Adam and Eve, when the children come to life, you find that one of the children kills the other. And very abusive behavior. And Jesus actually says when he speaks to the Pharisees in his day that from the time of Abel, he was the first persecuted one. He says he's the first persecuted one. And you persecuted all the prophets and now me. But he was the first one who was persecuted. Obviously by Abel, but when you pull the curtains apart, somebody else is pulling the strings. That's the thing. So, first he was the deceiver, the tempter and the deceiver. And then Satan becomes the abuser or the persecutor. And then he becomes the accuser, right? If you read the Bible, it's a big long story. Just try to pick up the bits as the story develops. The book of Job, for instance, Satan sort of accuses Job of serving God for wrong reasons, impure motives, you know, just gets his goodies from God, his blessings, that's why he serves God. If he didn't, he would not serve. But then, towards the end of the Old Testament, almost the end, the book of Zechariah, we have the vision of Satan accusing the high priest Joshua in the book of Zechariah. And that's where he's called accuser directly, accusing Joshua of wearing filthy garments, other being a sinner. And then God deals with him somehow. So that's what Satan does with us personally, but you can see it on the large scale also. So first he will tempt us, flashy, beautiful things, and deceive us into thinking these things are much more than they are, much greater than they are. And he will give us all the promises he can imagine, but he never plans to fulfill his promises. So he'll deceive us, well, he'll tempt us and deceive us. Once he's made his sale, then he'll turn nasty. And you talk about relationships. You can get into relationships that are like that. You know, somebody will come and promise, you know, all the brilliant things you will get in this life. Once you get into that relationship, you can turn nasty. And sooner rather than later, you find yourself in a, you're being chained into some sort of abusive relationship. And there's somebody who's abusing you and mistreating you. And in the end, then we tell you, oh, you're just imagining things, you're crazy. You know, just that's how it works. So on the large scale, Satan first tempts and deceives humankind. And then, when he manages to get them changed himself, then he becomes more direct and becomes shows himself who he is, the abuser, the persecutor, the murderer. And then at the end he'll turn to God and says, look at him, look at her. Can't have that, can you? Look what he's done. Look what she's done. Can't have that, God, can you? That's a story that runs in the background in the New in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. So these three things, the problems. If you imagine the numbers 1, 2, 3 representing here, the beginning of the story, that's Satan is the tempter and the deceiver. And Satan is the abuser, the persecutor, the murderer, and then Satan is the accuser. And how God chooses to deal with these things, it's quite interesting. As in the story I told you earlier, Christ comes to confront evil in this world, and he doesn't deal with it the way that we do, you know, shoot them, put them in prison. He actually allows evil to destroy him so that he can defeat it. It doesn't make sense to us, but it works. So stick the cross in the middle of the story. Why is the cross in the middle, in the center? Because that's when everything started to change. And in the book of Revelation, interestingly, you have the reversal of these three problems that have developed from the beginning until the cross. And you have really three comings of Christ. And each coming of Christ deals with one of these issues in reverse order. So if you go to Revelation chapter 12, that speaks of the first coming of Christ, his death and resurrection. Revelation chapter 12, verse 10. Then I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now salvation and strength in the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come. For, or because, the accuser of our brothers, who accuses them before our God day and night, has been cast down. So that number three, the last bit of Satan's work, not the tempter and deceiver, not the abuser, persecutor, but the accuser of us. Christ has dealt with it immediately with the cross and following the cross, with his first coming. So you have Satan on this earth was in havoc, and then suddenly the cross is planted down the earth, and things start to reverse and change. And the first thing that Christ has done with the cross, through the cross, through his resurrection, is to cast down the accuser. That's what Revelation tells us. The accuser of our brothers has been cast down. Well, that's been dealt with, so he's got no power to accuse us anymore. But we're still in a problem here, aren't we? For the last 2,000 years, the world still hasn't been such a grand place as it could have been if Christ was in charge. So then we have the story develops through the rest of the book of Revelation, and then there's the call for patient endurance of the saints. Just wait. That's the message. And then we have the second coming of Christ. I suppose Revelation chapter 19, where he comes on the white horse as a warrior, and just before that, In Revelation chapter 18, you have this power of Babylon, the mega persecutor, the global persecutor, persecuting unrestrainedly. And there is the picture of the fall of Babylon in chapter 18. And let's have a look. See that without my glasses? Doesn't matter really, but when you read the chapter 8, it's a very long chapter. It describes the power of Babylon. It's persecuting the saints and the holy people of God, and now the judgment has come here, and God says, pour into her cup double of what she has given to you. And this is the image of Satan as the incarnated persecutor in flesh, in the form of the beast of Babylon. And it's the mega persecutor. And this is the judgment of Babylon, followed by the second coming of Christ. So what you find is, at the time of the second coming of Christ, God deals with Satan as the persecutor, or the abuser, or the murderer, and he makes an end to Babylon. All the political powers of this world that have been linked with Satan, one way or the other, and it's gone. It's gone. So number two here, God, with his second coming, he deals with Babylon, or the mega persecutor, the abuser, the murderer of God's people and all those who suffer in this world. And that's good news for God's people, because the story really ends there for God's people, because the second coming of Christ, as Christ has promised, when I come back, I will take you with me, and you will be with me where I am, will be safe then. Safe from the wolf, safe from the lion, the persecuting powers of this world, imbued by the spirit of Satan. But unfortunately, the story doesn't end yet, because after chapter 19, there's more story there, isn't it? And it's so elaborate and long, and I read through it at some point in time, I'm just wondering, why is it? Just get on with it and do it, you know, just come and sort things out. But then I realized that there's a big, massive, large thing going on out there that we cannot see behind the curtains in the spirit realm, this universe, things that God has to deal with to be able finally to bring an end to all sin and evil in this world. It's a big, big job, and only He knows how to deal with it and when to sort it out. So there's the third coming of Christ. The third coming of Christ. Because go back to Revelation chapter 19, that's the second coming of Christ. Christ comes on the white horse as the warrior. He destroys all his enemies with the sword that comes out of his mouth, which is the word of God. Just like at the time of creation, when he spoke his word, everything came to be. When he comes for the second time, he will speak and everything will turn to dust again. And then, followed by this, you go into chapter 20, it's a bit weird chapter, talking about millennium, and difficult to know what it means. But Satan is bound and chained, and he's trapped for 1,000 years. Revelation chapter 20, verse 1. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. He laid hold of the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. So we're going back to the image from Genesis, the serpent. He's going back to the very beginning now. Yeah? And that's how the story develops. So what happens when he's released? Now when the 1,000 years have expired, verse 7, 27, now when the 1,000 years have expired, Satan will be released from his prison and will go out to do what? sin, the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, whose number is as the sand of the sea. There is the battle described. The fire comes from heaven, and that's the end of the story, really. But the key word here is the sea. So, chapter 20 introduces us again to the word serpent, which is the key idea from the Garden of Eden. And when he's released, the serpent is released after this 1,000 years, he goes out to deceive those who have not been gathered by Christ at the second coming, his people. So what do we find here at the end? Christ, at his third coming, deals with Satan as the deceiver. So he reverses all the mess that Satan has made in this world. He deals with it step by step in his own time. So, number one, Satan's been introduced as the tempter and deceiver in the Garden of Eden. And then, two, he turns into a nasty abuser, persecutor, and murderer. And three, he turns into accuser. You know. And then the cross is planted into the earth. Christ has come. And with his death and resurrection, immediately, Satan has been cast down as the accuser of our brother in Revelation 12. In Revelation 18 and 19, Satan, embodied in Babylon and the beast, has been destroyed as the persecutor of God's people, God's prophets and saints and his people. And at the end, in Revelation 20, he deals with the last bit that needs to be dealt with. Maybe it can help us understand why the time stretches so far then. And God deals with Satan as the deceiver. That's the last bit. And it needs to be dealt with before everything can be set right again. Because that's the root of all problems, isn't it? It's not the abuse and persecution and accusations. Because it all started with the deception. Yeah? So I can only imagine that the reason we're still here is that the plan, whether it's God's plan, Satan's plan, both plans are still working out. And there is still the big of deception left to be dealt with. God has already dealt with accusations against us and us as sinners, our sins, through the cross. We don't need to worry about that anymore. And God will deal at his second coming of Christ with Satan as the persecutor. Once he comes, nobody can touch us anymore. No more harm can come to us of any kind. But then at the very end, Satan is presented as the serpent who comes out to deceive all those nations who have been laid in the dust in the graves to wait for Satan to be released. It's very difficult to understand this game. I still wonder why. But if you read it in the context of the entire Bible, then it's a bit more acceptable, and you understand. The last stop for God is to destroy Satan as the deceiver, because that's what started all the problems in this world. And I suppose in some way everything will become clear in the end. To us, hopefully us, as God's people observing that from a safe point, vantage point at that time, to those people who have been deceived by Satan in the end, when God shows himself, and we all face God as we are, and we see ourselves for who we truly are. And then, only then, he will bring end to Satan as the deceiver after all these things have expired. And only then, it will be safe to restart everything again and make this earth new, and give each one of us a room in his Father's house, as he has promised, and we'll have a home on the new earth. They'll be free from Satan and sin and evil, where we'll be with him forever and ever. And there'll be no more third party that was there from the beginning of the story. No more serpent, there's just us and God. And this key phrase repeats in the relation towards the end. And I will be their God and they'll be my people. That's relationship. And they'll see me face to face. And there's no third party anymore, just the two. And that's the good ending to the story. Thank you.